CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, we bring you coverage of the International AIDS Conference. And on commentary, Brad Papink brings us a look at human rights issues this week. We'll have all this, plus arts and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next 45 minutes right here on News 101. Up first this evening, here is Radio Free UBC with their take at UBC-related news. Here is Jeremy Wood and Isabel Krupp.
Hey, UBC. Welcome back to Radio Free, your source for student power, your radical angle on all the news at school, affecting school, and at the end of the day, affecting you. So we're not going to be here too long. Stick with us and tune in, turn on, drop out. And our main story of the day is a recount of the ongoing issues with the campus plan with Isabel.
Right, so today I'm going to be talking about campus and community planning's development plan for UBC campus. They're going to be holding a series of workshops and conferences in mid to late October to develop this plan. But essentially, the plan that they're putting forth consists of three different options. Now, the first option is to develop the UBC Forum, which we at Radio Free are pretty opposed to. According to campus and community planning, the pros would be that they could build human-scale buildings, which means four or five stories tall, on the farm, and it would allow for free space on campus because, of course, they would be developing the farm and not the campus core. The cons of this option would be that, according to campus and community planning, the cons would be to that the plan would increase carbon emissions because of the apparent commute from the farm to the campus core. Also, human-scale buildings are supposedly less efficient than condo towers. And furthermore, this option would provide less social opportunities that the other options would provide. Of course, the cons don't include the actual destruction of the UBC farm, which to us is definitely a deal breaker for option number one. Now, option number two of campus and community planning's campus plan is to disperse five development neighborhoods throughout the campus. One of these neighborhoods would be the farm. So this option would mean the partial development of the UBC farm. Campus and community planning, CCP, calls this the neutral option. We call it the compromise option. According to CCP, this is carbon neutral, it's socially neutral, but for us, again, development of the farm is really a deal breaker. Now, option number three is the development of the University Boulevard, the campus core. This, according to CCP, is really overwhelmingly positive. It would mean free space through the intensification of the development of the core, and it would mean carbon neutrality and environmental sustainability because there wouldn't be the commute from the farm to the campus core, the academic core. And this would also provide so-called social opportunity, which they refer to as interdisciplinary encounters. The idea is that development of U Boulevard would lead to more 24/7 establishments, coffee shops, at which you could meet with professors and other members of the campus community and develop a really healthy social kind of social life. We're a little bit skeptical of whether this would really happen, whether commercialization leads to more social opportunity, and so those are the three options presented by CCP. None of these are really up to Radio Free's standards. Developing and commercializing U Boulevard, University Boulevard, the campus core, is exactly what we, the activists of UBC, have fought against for the past several years. And in fact, development of the U Boulevard has been halted by activism. So essentially, what we see the CCP as doing is holding the farm hostage, basically saying either we'll develop the farm or we'll develop U Boulevard. And neither of these are good options in our eyes. But of course, we would prefer U Boulevard to be developed over the farm. However, we think that there are more options than just these three. For example, there could be development of low-density areas of campus, including South Campus, which does not include the farm. So we at Radio Free, in collaboration with SDS, are going to be starting a new round of petitions. And the demands that we're making, and we hope that this resonates with students at large, is the affordable participation in campus life for all students. So that's to say that all students can participate in campus life without any economic barriers, and this includes living on campus. We also demand the farm's immediate and future security to be secured. Now, option number three, the U Boulevard development option, claims to leave the to spare the UBC farm. But in reality, it's only really sparing the farm in the immediate present. We want the farm to be secure now and forever. We also demand that commercial development on campus be student-owned or institutionalized. Now, this means we don't want outside corporations to be developing on campus. We don't want labor to be outsourced and non-union workers to be employed on campus. We also demand that all residential development hold student housing as a priority, therefore working with our first demand in that participation in campus life must be affordable to all students. So the basic premise of the petition is that the campus plan put forth by CCP include a fourth viable option that adheres to all of our demands outside of the three that they claim are the only options for campus development.
Thank you, Isabel. One of the morals of that story is that we here at Radio Free love the farm, and so should you. So after you listen to our good friends here at the news, you should turn off your radio and head down to the farm for Farm Aid, which is a festival, a circus of sorts, going on at the farm until 7 o'clock, featuring some agricultural rock and roll. Amongst them, headliners, the Agora String Band, who have been playing farms all over the Lower Mainland, and who feature Matt Filipiak, former president of the Graduate Student Society. So you should go check that out. A few other things coming up. Tomorrow we have some more stuff at the farm, some workshops, including bacon and brewing and all sorts of fun stuff. Later at night from 2:45 to 8:15 are a number of talks, a number of lectures at the Macmillan Building, including our headliners later in the our keynotes later in the night. There'll be a free dinner provided by Community Eats, so thank you to you guys. There's a conference on creating new alternative media. It's today, so if you can make it, from 7 to 10 at the Socialist Education Center on 706 Clark Street, featuring Derek O'Keefe from Stop War, amongst others. There's going to be a jam space next Kerner Monday, September 29th, starting at 7. So, I mean, that's just about reclaiming space on campus for music, which doesn't really make sense because it's open mic, but go there to support them. Storytelling Our Lives at the SFU Harbor Center, which is a collection of monologues about issues of migration. And from October 2nd to 5th, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, are creating a refugee camp at Library Square. So just check that out. And most importantly, next Friday, 5 o'clock, Radio Free again. Every Tuesday, 7 o'clock, is Cinema Politica, where some friends of ours are putting on progressive documentaries every week. And they're all free, and they're all great. And should check that out, too. So without further ado, we'll turn you back to our friends at the news. Like I said, they have some good things to say, but afterwards, head down to the farm. I'll see you next week, UBC.
And thanks very much to Jeremy and Isabel for that piece. We're going to cut now to a quick break, but when we come back, we will bring you our headlines of local and international news.
Hey, are you ready to head back to school in September?
For sure, but I'm worried that I won't be able to cover all my costs this year.
Have you ever done work study? I did it in the past, and it was a great experience and good money. You just need to be a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident.
And studying at UBC?
You got it. If you want to earn decent coin, pad your resume, and work on campus, work study is where the smart money's at. Just go online to Career Services and check out the listings.
That's solid advice. I'll definitely check out work study this year.
For more information on getting hired for a work study job, visit www.students.ubc.ca/work study.
CITR 101.9 FM, in conjunction with the Vancouver International Film Festival, present Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. Faubourg Tremé, also known as the Sixth Ward, is one of the oldest black neighborhoods in America. Executive producer Wynton Marsalis and directors Don Logson and Lawless Eric Ellie have fashioned a love song come documentary to the Tremé as it is known throughout New Orleans. The film recounts the history of the place, credited with giving birth to both the civil rights movement and jazz music. Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans, screens Thursday, October 2nd at 3 o'clock p.m. and Friday, October 3rd at 8:45 p.m. at the Empire Granville 7. Presented by CITR 101.9 FM.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:15. Now, with a look at the headlines, here are News 101 reporters Sarah Ripplinger and Carrie Baptist.
In international news, in provincial news, many British Columbians are skeptical about the provincial government's ability to knock greenhouse gas emissions down to 77% of 2007 levels by 2020. According to an Ipsos Reid poll conducted for CBC News, two-thirds of BC residents were not confident the target set out by Premier Gordon Campbell in September 2007 can be met. The poll also revealed that the environmental focus that has dominated over the past couple of years may be shifting. Results show that healthcare, poverty, gasoline prices, and the economy are the top-of-mind issues for British Columbians ahead of the environment. A large percentage of British Columbians also said they are not willing to make the changes that might be necessary for the Campbell government to achieve its two CO2 reduction targets. 21% of residents polled said they are unwilling to change their driving habits, regardless of the high cost of gasoline. 41% said they believe increasing the frequency of public transit trips could convince more people to take the bus and other services, but 24% said that nothing could convince them to use public transit. No way, no how. 900 people were polled for the survey, which was conducted from September 3rd to 9th, and is considered accurate to within plus or minus 3.3%, 19 times out of 20, according to the CBC Online.
Provincial Premier Gordon Campbell criticized federal NDP leader Jack Layton's promise to do away with the Canada-US softwood lumber agreement. Campbell called Layton's proposal to end the agreement that he said it showed profound ignorance of the impact such a plan would have on BC. The Premier suggested the axing lumber agreement would cause huge layoffs in an industry that is already struggling. Campbell had previously promised not to intervene in the federal campaign, despite criticism of his controversial carbon tax by Nature Resources Minister Gary Lunn.
And in international news, paleontologists have discovered a dinosaur so small it could fit into a chicken coop. Albertonicus borealis was discovered in Alberta while a team headed by leading paleontologist Phil Curry was excavating in Dry Island Buffalo Jump Provincial Park, according to a Globe and Mail report. The tiny dinosaur weighed about as much as a chicken, walked on two legs, and twitched around a long tail. Its tiny arms made it unable to burrow, but were strong enough to tear apart logs. But you won't see this little guy clucking around the chicken coop. It had its heyday 700 million years ago. The markets might be plummeting, but worldwide CO2 emissions aren't. According to a panel of international scientists, global carbon dioxide emissions are up 3% this year from last year. The United States and China are the main producers of the gas that is one of the prime contributors to climate change. China's emissions accounted for over half of the planetary increase, according to figures released by science agencies in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia. The United States came in second, with its total emissions rising by 2% to 1.75 billion tons of carbon in 2007 compared to 2006. The rise comes after China surpassed the U.S. in terms of total carbon dioxide emissions in 2006. The increase is higher than the worst-case scenario forecast by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2007, the Globe and Mail reports. Scientists say that if the current rate of increase continues, sea level rise and temperature could reach the highest predicted levels. IPCC climate scenarios released in 2007 predicted a global temperature rise of between 2.4 to 6.3 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. The results are based on findings from the giant oil company BP PLC that looked at CO2 produced by burning fossil fuels and the production of cement.
President George Bush may have been responsible for saving the world from a global war by refusing to attack Iran. This spring, Israel gave serious thought to launching a military strike on Iran's nuclear sites, a senior European diplomatic source told the Guardian newspaper. Apparently, George Bush told then-Prime Minister Ehud Olmert during Bush's trip to Israel for the 60th anniversary of the state's founding that he would not support Israel and did not expect to revise that view for the rest of his presidency. The paper asserts that even if Israel were to launch an attack on Iran without U.S. approval, its planes could not reach their targets without the U.S. becoming aware of their flight path and having time to ask them to abandon their mission.
And up next, we are pleased to introduce a new segment on News 101, The Right of Way, covering human rights issues from around the world each week.
Coming up on The Right of Way, the federal election is drawing near and candidates are being shattered by economic woes, but Stand Canada will be following every step of the election to ensure that Darfur is a campaign issue.
It's important because anyone who is in that situation would be asking for people who are in this part of the world who have all the liberties that we do and finances and energy and time to, I mean, they would be calling for us to do all that we could to help them out.
And later, we will continue with last week's look at the role of technology in the lives of human rights defenders, journalists, and everyone in between.
Here in the West, seemingly innocuous social networking sites like Facebook may be mainly used to connect old school friends and play movie quizzes, but in the Middle East, these sites are quickly becoming virtual platforms for very real and very repressed political causes.
All that coming up on The Right of Way.
This is The Right of Way, human rights, human wrongs, and what we do about them.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Pepping. Darfur remains a highly topical subject as human rights organizations continue to classify the conflict as a genocide. Stand Canada, previously known as Students Taking Action Now Darfur, is striving to raise awareness of the conflict. According to a report from Stand Canada's website, the crisis began in 2003 when rebel groups launched a series of attacks on government military installations. This caught the Sudanese government by surprise, and with few troops in the area and still heavily engaged in the civil war in the south, they responded by expanding and further arming the Arab militias, commonly known as the Janjaweed, and launching a campaign backed by the Sudanese military against non-Arab communities. Both Sudanese military forces and the Janjaweed, sometimes acting independently and sometimes in conjunction, have deliberately targeted non-Arab civilians in clear violation of international law. They are engaging in a campaign to destroy non-Arab communities in Darfur in an effort to undermine the rebel groups. Since the outbreak of hostilities in 2003, the crisis in Darfur has resulted in well over 200,000 largely civilian deaths, the displacement of more than 2 million people, and the suffering of millions more. The decision by the government of Sudan to conduct ethnic cleansing as a counterinsurgency campaign has attracted significant international condemnation, but relatively little action to date. Some hope came with the deployment of the United Nations African Union Mission in Darfur, or UNAMID, in January 2008. However, as of February, only 9,000 of the expected 26,000 troops had been deployed, and the mission lacked key equipment, including helicopters. To date, the area remains unstable and awaits the remaining deployment of thousands of peacekeepers, whose presence is needed to make a significant impact in the region. So on Friday, September the 19th, I joined Stand UBC on their march for Darfur. But before the march, I joined some students outside the Students' Union building on the grassy knoll and asked, what do you know about Darfur?
I know absolutely nothing. I know it's not in North America. That's all I know.
Wonderful. So you know it's a place. That's a good start. And what about yourself?
Same thing. I know that there's stuff going on there that not everyone agrees with, and people are not being treated correctly.
Basically nothing.
All right. And?
Don't know.
So I just want to ask one quick question. What do you know about Darfur?
Not an awful lot.
Genocide?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
And do you think you'll be participating in the march today?
I didn't know there was a march. The sign is right there, honey.
And so the demonstration began. Stand UBC had arranged for three federal candidates to speak to a crowd of Darfur supporters. Deborah Meredith, the Conservative candidate for Vancouver Quadra, Green Party candidate Dan Grace of the Vancouver Quadra, and Hedy Fry, the Liberal candidate of Vancouver Central, took a shot at wooing potential voters. I spoke with Liberal Hedy Fry about support for Darfur being localized to campuses. She had this to say. Thank you for being with us today. One quick question. I just wanted to know if you find it difficult to raise the issue of Darfur to other groups, because it seems like Darfur seems to be a localized campaign issue here on campuses. Do you find it difficult to raise this issue with other voters?
No, I'm a Liberal. And we brought in from under Lester Pearson those three Ds. One of them is the defense or the duty to protect civilians in areas of conflict. And we believe that we should step in, and we should always step in under the United Nations to protect civilians, to protect women, children, women who are raped, to prevent victims of war, and to prevent anybody who is hurt in any kind of civilian conflict or civil war. We also, the second D, of course, is diplomacy. Where we participate and have been always, Canada is the negotiator of the world. You just have to read about how Canada used to be the negotiator of the world, where we were sent always to try and help peace talks to occur, to try and find common ground, to try and build those kinds of diplomatic things that we do, as well as the democratic solutions of creating democratic institutions, helping people to understand how to create a police force, to create strong democratic institutions that will help the country to flourish once a peaceful negotiation has been agreed to. And of course, the third one is development, to be able to aid and help people who are displaced, to be able to give aid to people who don't have any infrastructure, any water, any sewage, any hospitalization, any medicines, etc. So Canada has always been committed to this. This was started by Lester Pearson, who won a Nobel Prize for this, and he was a Liberal Prime Minister. We've kept that up. And so when we entered Darfur way back in 2002, we immediately was one of the top donors, and we are now one of the top three donors into the whole process of diplomacy, peace talks, democratic rebuilding, and the ability to protect citizens.
Last to the stand was Conservative candidate Deborah Meredith. Here's a brief recording of what she had to say.
We're proud of our record in Darfur. Darfur is horrible. It's a human catastrophe. You know, different figures have been bandied about. I thought there were 400 million killed. I see 300 million killed. It's a huge number of people killed. It's horrible. 2.5 million people displaced. This can't go on.
She continued in her speech to mention that she supports Canada's initiative to stabilize the area by sending RCMP officers to the area to help train and maintain some sort of peace. I caught up with her after her speech and asked her this. From speaking with Stand members, I've gathered that they are quite frustrated with the fact that Canada, even though the United Nations has deemed it necessary to send 26,000 peacekeeping troops, that Canada has only pledged 12. Six of which are already in Darfur, six more to come in the hopefully near future. Do you believe that 12 peacekeeping troops is enough to stabilize the region?
Oh, I doubt it. I think it might help, but I doubt that
number of people could stabilize what's been a horror show for the last few decades.
And so is it the Conservative government plan to continue in this vein, or do you think if we see an election where the Conservatives gain a majority, we will see a much broader spectrum of occurrences in the Darfur area?
Well, I think that the aid that is being provided is very, very generous right now. And without an invitation to the UN to take peacekeepers into Darfur, I don't think that Canada would go in on its own.
Which brings us back to the march. Stand UBC members led a group of participants across the UBC campus, singing songs and carrying signs, back towards the grassy knoll where they participated in a die-in, tracing their bodies in chalk on the pavement, each body to represent 10,000 dead in Darfur. And after the march, I spoke with one participant about why he thought it was important to take part in a demonstration to raise awareness about what is happening in Sudan.
It's important because anyone who is in that situation would be asking for people who are in this part of the world who have all the liberties that we do and finances and energy and time to, I mean, they would be calling for us to do all that we could to help them out.
Now I'd like to bring it back to you, UBC campus, Vancouver, British Columbia, or worldwide. Do you believe that this march was successful? It's been 1 week since the march, and it seems like the idea of Darfur may have even slipped from the minds of candidates, students, and everyone alike. Stand UBC would like to thank all those who participated in the march, and would also like to invite all others to come out and participate if they please. You can check them out online at www.standubc.blogspot.com. Again, that's www.standubc.blogspot.com. And I'd like to encourage you, the listeners, to give me any feedback. Was this a successful event? Did you hear them come into your dorm room? Or should this be done in the future to raise awareness for candidates? You can contact us here at The Right of Way at news@citr.ca. And now I'd like to return to a discussion that we started last week about the role of technology in the lives of everyone, human rights defenders, journalists, and everyone in between. We'll be looking at a short clip from Radio Netherlands' broadcast, The State We're In.
Here in the West, seemingly innocuous social networking sites like Facebook may be mainly used to connect old school friends and play movie quizzes, but in the Middle East, these sites are quickly becoming virtual platforms for very real and very repressed political causes.
And so this brought an important question at a very interesting time in Canada. This week, Concordia University has banned access to Facebook on campus computers, the CBC reports. University staff assert that the university's desktop network is vulnerable to hackers who may be using the popular social networking site to access personal information. The school is concerned that the information could then be used to launch attacks on its systems. This development has left the question about the role of Facebook as a tool for communication and the risks it involves. Is denying student access to Facebook crucial to maintaining technological safety? Or is Facebook and the internet so paramount to freedom that Concordia should reevaluate their intentions? This role of technology in the access to the internet plays a crucial role in political spheres and how information is distributed. As we have come to learn, foreign and domestic journalists suffered major censoring in Beijing before and during the Olympics. Access to human rights sites, such as Amnesty International, and sites concerning Tibet, Tiananmen Square, or the religious sect Falun Gong, were denied to reporters covering the Olympics. Amnesty International also reports major human rights violations amongst journalists in China, citing the imprisonment of those who report on human rights abuses. The topic of human rights and access to technology was also recently addressed in an episode of Radio Netherlands, The State We're In. Questions of how the access to the internet is a key factor in ensuring the democratic process were highlighted in stories of how Facebook use encourages activists in Egypt and Turkey, as well as a story of the political sphere of blogging in the Middle East. Cell phones used by reporters and ordinary citizens, giving a voice to those oppressed by war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo via text messaging, suggests a new age of political dialogue. And documenting the Iraq war by civilians on their cell phone cameras gives a proportional image of true events, beyond the censoring hands of media. That's all we have today for The Right of Way, Human Rights, Human Wrongs, and What We Do About Them. I'm Brad Pepping. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or concerns, please send us an email at news@citr.ca. Thanks, and have yourselves a great weekend.
And thanks to Brad for this edition of Right of Way. Stay tuned for that reoccurring segment in upcoming News 101 broadcasts on Fridays. Up next, for more international news, we move on to another exclusive News 101 piece. Here is Carrie Baptist's piece on the International AIDS Conference.
For this report on the International AIDS Conference, I'll be looking at the increasing criminalization of AIDS. In many countries around the world, it has become a crime to willfully infect another person with AIDS. As Michaela Clayton, the director of AIDS and Rights Alliance South Africa, will explain, seemingly well-meaning laws can have troubling consequences even in Canada.
So, just to kick off, in terms of where, we've seen in the last 6 months some really disturbing cases. In Texas, for example, we've seen a man convicted of assault with a deadly weapon for spitting. He was convicted of assault with a deadly weapon for spitting because he was HIV positive, and he was sentenced to 35 years in jail. In Switzerland, recently a man was sent to jail for infecting his girlfriend with HIV, even though he thought he was HIV negative. And much more recently, something I saw yesterday on the internet, was in Canada, a Zimbabwean immigrant was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment on a guilty plea to aggravated sexual assault for not disclosing his HIV status to 8 women before engaging in consensual unprotected sex. And none of the women became positive. In Africa, unfortunately, as Judge Cameron mentioned, we've seen an epidemic. I think what Judge Michael Kirby has referred to as an epidemic of highly ineffective laws. Starting off with a model law on HIV, that the development of which was funded by USAID. It was a model law that was developed in N'Djamena in Chad and has proliferated throughout the region. It has some disturbing provisions in terms of disclosure of HIV status and also in terms of willful transmission. It requires disclosure of HIV positive status to a spouse or regular sexual partner as soon as possible after learning about your status and at the most within 6 weeks of diagnosis. I'm not sure why 6 weeks, it seems a little arbitrary, but there we go. And then in terms of the offense of willful transmission, we see that it is defined so broadly in terms of being defined as through any means with full knowledge of status, which is wide enough even to cover mother-to-child transmission. So effectively we're criminalizing women who infect their children during pregnancy through fault of their own or not.
As Ms. Clayton says, it's a situation where good intentions have led to bad policy, especially from a public health perspective.
Criminalization is bad public policy. It doesn't reduce the spread of HIV. If you think of the usual functions of criminal law, those of incapacitation, locking somebody up in prison, rehabilitation, deterrence, none of those will achieve what we desire, which is reducing the spread of HIV. In terms of incapacitation, you can lock somebody away in prison, but prison is one of the highest risk environments for HIV infection. And prisoners also go back into society. In terms of rehabilitation, there's very little evidence to suggest that criminal penalties will rehabilitate. Sexual behavior is very complicated, and it's unlikely that putting somebody in prison is going to rehabilitate sexual behavior. Deterrence is also an unlikely scenario. It's unlikely that just because you put a law in place, people are going to not engage in willful transmission if that's what they've set out to do. I mean, we have laws that make it illegal to murder people. We have laws that make it illegal to rape people, but people still do it. transmission can also undermine prevention efforts, and I think this is critically important. It is a deterrent for testing. If you are threatened with prosecution for knowing your HIV status, it is much easier not to know your HIV status. Also, using criminal law to address transmission often spreads misinformation about HIV. We've seen media reports of cases where these overbroad ambit of transmission provisions, which include spitting and biting and scratching, spread a lot of misinformation about how HIV is actually transmitted. It also creates a sense of false security. Because if you think that, okay, because there's a criminal provision, nobody's going to go out and infect anybody else, you can assume that you don't have to practice safe sex. It creates a sense of false security, and it also creates distrust between people living with HIV and AIDS and healthcare providers if they think that information can potentially be used against them in a criminal case. It contributes to stigma, and it further stigmatizes people living with HIV as potential criminals. People living with HIV are a potential criminal threat.
It's somewhat ironic that in many places it's actually women's groups who are pushing for criminalization, as most of the time women are actually the first ones to know who are HIV if they are HIV positive, and on top of that, they often don't have the power within their relationships to insist on safe sex. So women are many times the first to know, but they can't disclose their status to their partner for fear of violence or fear of rejection, and they can't insist on safer sex, and therefore, under these new laws, they are liable for prosecution. More than that, Ms. Clayton brings up the issue about how these laws will be applied.
There is a real risk that criminal provisions will be used for selective prosecution of men who have sex with men, sex workers, intravenous drug users.
Even if the application of these laws is fair, it would be difficult to prove definitively that a particular person has infected another person, let alone that the act was willful. Beyond that, it is unclear why we need special AIDS-specific laws to deal with the issue. No other infectious disease is treated in the same way, with specific laws being created to criminalize its spread. Next week, I will be highlighting one South African man's incredible story, facing and dealing with HIV/AIDS.
And thank you, of course, to Carrie for her exclusive coverage of the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City. As she mentioned, she will be back next Friday with more from that conference. It's now time to turn things over to Tracy Fuller for a look at the arts.
Hey there, everyone. Happy Friday. This is Tracy Fuller, and I'm the new arts director here at CITR. Every Friday afternoon, I will be joining the Friday news team to bring you the fuller perspective on what's going on in Vancouver's arts scene. So let's get things started. Last night, the Vancouver International Film Festival opened with a premiere screening of Blindness, Don McKellar's new screenplay. The film is an eerie apocalyptic story about what might happen if the world were to undergo an epidemic of blindness. The movie is laugh-out-loud funny at times and cry-your-eyes-out terrifying at others. Certainly, it's not for the faint of heart, but it is a fascinating exploration of human nature. Starring Don McKellar himself, who was at the film premiere last night, Julianne Moore, Mark Ruffalo, and Gael Garcia Bernal, the movie has lots of stars and lots of interesting people to watch. I would recommend this film, but it's certainly not for everyone, so maybe to those of you who are a bit more in the suspense and thriller genre, that one's for you. But otherwise, you may know that CITR is the official sponsor, or one official sponsor at VIFF this year. We're presenting a film called Fauberge Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. And that'll be screening at the Empire Grand on Thursday, October 2nd at 3 o'clock and Friday, October 3rd at 8:45. We're also sponsoring the Meet the Filmmakers events, which will happen between September 29th and October 8th. So make sure you get out to those items. Otherwise, around town, next Thursday at the Chan Center, local singer-songwriter Alex Cuba will bring his Cuban-inspired music to UBC. You can catch him at 5 p.m. for $10 if you're a student. Also, other things going on in theater. The History Boys opened at the Granville Island stage last night, and my arts reviewer Paul Riviere will be having a review on that for next Wednesday's Arts Report. Tickets are $30 and $45. Headlines Theater is opening Shattering tomorrow night at the Japanese Hall, which is 475 Alexander. It's a hard-hitting interactive production taking on the subject of addiction in our communities. Tickets are pay what you can. In music, Ben Heppner and the CBC Radio Orchestra will be performing at the Chan Center this Sunday as part of UBC's Centenary Gala. That's at 3 p.m., and tickets are available through Ticketmaster. The Vancouver Symphony Orchestra is also opening this weekend. They'll be playing Schumann's Cello Concerto and Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet Suite. Tickets start at $18. The iconic Beach Boys will also be playing in Vancouver this weekend. They're playing two sold-out shows at the River Rock. In festivals, the Vancouver City Limits Festival is on at the Beaumont Studios tomorrow, and the Word on the Street Festival is going on this Sunday at Library Square. The Britannia Library is hosting a free workshop this Sunday with relationships specialist Ruth Nyman. The workshop is called Intimate Relationships, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And that's tomorrow from 10 until 12 for free. So if you're having relationship problems, maybe you want to head out to that. Closing at the galleries this weekend are Nude, featuring works by Baudot, Chin, Urquhart, Woolley, and others at the Exposure Gallery on East Broadway. Also closing is Jason DeGraff's new works at the Jocanda Gallery, which is on Granville. Seduction, which is photography and other works by Martin Brudette, will close at the Elliott Lewis Gallery on East 1st this weekend. And Pat Service's Valleys, which are pastoral landscapes, will close at the Diane Ferris Gallery this weekend. And that's the Fuller Perspective on Arts this week. For more arts news, make sure you turn into my new arts show called, of all things, The Arts Report. You can listen to it here, right here on CITR, on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope you have a great afternoon. My name is Tracy Fuller, and that's the Fuller Perspective.
And thank you, Tracy. Before we go tonight, we'll check in with meteorologist Henry Fung for a look at your weekend weather. Henry?
Thanks, Rita. A zonal pattern at the 250 hectopascal level is expected to steer a cold front, currently at 130 degrees west, quickly across the south coast overnight through tomorrow morning. However, the 94 millibar low is weakening and should only bring scattered showers to the south coast. Looking at the mid-troposphere analysis maps, with the 570 dm control line approaching us and with positive thickness advection, we may be looking at a last glimpse of summer for the weekend. As the frontal system passes, winds should pick up to a moderate northwesterly breeze or about 15 knots near water through tomorrow afternoon. So for tonight, cloudy with scattered showers and a low of 11. Tomorrow, cloudy in the morning, then clearing out in the afternoon. Winds from the northwest at 25 kilometers per hour and a high of 17. A sunny Sunday with a high of 23 for inland portions of Greater Vancouver and 19 for the airport. Even warmer on Monday, high of 25 for inland portions and 20 for the airport. However, a little chilly overnight with lows of 9. That's your weather for weekend.
And thank you so much, Henry, for that. That's our program for Friday, September 26, 2008. We are finishing early today to hand off the airwaves to Thunderbird Ion Sports and their broadcast of live hockey. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, we're always welcoming you. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening.
Following is a live presentation of CITR Sports.